Right before the pandemic hit, the restaurant industry was having a remarkable run. Places were opening up everywhere. Talented chefs with big dreams were giving it a go. And then disaster. And that isn't overstating it. When all is said and done, somewhere between 20 and 80% of all restaurants in this country will close because of the disruption of the virus. Milo Carrier is a chef in Salt Lake City, and he picked the worst possible time to open Arlo. That's the name of his restaurant.
I have had an interest in cooking and food for about as long as I can remember. I recall learning how to cook from my mother and my grandmothers at a very young age. And hey, Mom. Can you give me an example of something that we used to cook?
We make calzones.
Calzones? I don't remember that.
Lasagna. Enchiladas.
I was always responsible for making the salad dressing. Very important. Gathering around the table. My earliest and most consistent memories. I spent some time working in kitchens in San Francisco and New Zealand, and then eventually moved back to Salt Lake City because I felt like this was a good place to start the process of opening a restaurant and accomplishing that goal. And I found a lot of inspiration in the cooking of cultures that do more with less. We started construction on the building right around the middle of January, and we were originally slated to open at the end of April, maybe middle of May of 2020.
It's a new type of coronavirus.
Coronavirus officially hitting the U.S. Here's what we know.
When the COVID-19 pandemic started to really spread and take hold, things started to get a little bit tense, and we started to feel some of the effects with construction. And the timeline just started to extend.
We must take necessary steps to prevent the spread of this virus any further. These will not be easy steps, in fact.
Tonight marks the beginning of the first weekend since Utah enacted restrictions on bars and restaurants.
Basically deserted here, and this is a night that is usually really busy.
The physical labor involved with renovating the space was really helpful for me to take my mind off of this kind of overwhelming anxiety about the state of the restaurant industry.
Governor Gary Herbert does plan to begin reopening the state's economy.
So we're going to have a myriad of people in here without masks, which is potentially dangerous to my staff.
But as we kept working and as things kept getting delayed and the project kept going, the exterior situation continued to change.
Some restrictions may still be keeping workers at home.
It was very difficult to make sense of the different guidelines and regulations.
There are concerns that the restrictions put in place to reduce the spread of COVID-19 will also reduce the number of employees to come and serve at the restaurants.
Once we finally got open, in some ways, is that thing that I had conceived of. And we are able to invite people into the space and sit on our patio and serve them. But in other ways, it feels very kind of subdued or limited and restricted. To be in this place, to have it open and have everything else going on is like, it's almost unreal. I mean, it's a lot for me to even process, but I don't know. It's kind of like cooking itself in a broader sense where we look at what we have available and make changes based on that. I'm committed to keeping this thing afloat and continuing to push and make it as good as I can for as long as possible.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of restaurants. Matthew Goulding writes about food and the industry. He has a piece in The Atlantic with the grim title, An Extinction Event for America's Restaurants. Goulding talked to dozens of people. He talked to chefs and bartenders, writers, economists. He wanted to know what it would be like to go out for a meal when all the dust has settled after the pandemic. But it isn't just the virus that's closing places all over the country. Goulding says that just may be the final straw because making and serving food to people has been unsustainable for years. This is a local story, of course, as well as a national one, and we'll hear from people making a go of it here in just a bit, because this is a story about our culture. Goulding told us restaurants are never just restaurants. They're mirrors of a society.
I think that there was probably a time in sort of American food culture where we looked at restaurants largely as places to fill up, and where maybe our cultural appreciation of restaurants in the landscape of the country maybe didn't run as deep as it did in, say, in certain parts of Europe or in parts of Asia. But it's always been a pivotal piece of society where we gather, where we share ideas, where we tell stories. And even beyond that, where without us necessarily being conscious of it, when we step into a restaurant and we support that restaurant with our presence, with our time, and above all, with our dollars, we're supporting a long chain of decisions that are made by the owners, where and how they purchase their food, the rights they give their employees and how they support those employees, the ideals behind sort of the general philosophy of the food they're serving and the service that they give you. Inherent in all of those choices is sort of it's a vote, yeah, as an eater. And I think that that's one of the most sort of remarkable pieces of the restaurant landscape. So we're not talking about simply losing or the potential of losing a place to eat a burger or a place to have Chinese takeout. We're talking about losing a vital piece of the American fabric.
You sort of pinpoint the day the American restaurant died. California, you say. This was the first of what you describe as this 50-state cascade. Let's talk about the era that ended.
Sure.
With all of that, where were we? So we can talk about at least where it's heading, because you describe it as one of the most momentous and successful runs in the industry's history. Explain that.
It's no surprise to anybody listening that restaurant culture, food culture, has been going through sort of an extraordinary cultural moment. You know, the age of foodieism, the age of Instagram, social media, sharing meals that we eat. People young and old were supporting restaurants in ways that they hadn't done before, from top to bottom. And I think we saw sort of a boom of restaurants opening of all stripes, from, you know, your local mom and pop diners to taquerias to noodle joints to very specific cultural representations of corners of the world. And American food culture suddenly was very diverse. It could hang with the big European elite cultures of France and Spain and Italy in terms of the high-end restaurants. And so this was an explosion of restaurant love that took place across the country. And so that's kind of where we came into this. I don't mean to say that it was all great. And I'm not saying that the restaurant industry was healthy in all senses, but certainly that it had built out to be a very diverse and sort of well-founded cultural institution in the United States in ways that it hadn't before. Mm. And so when you come up to March 19th, which is the day that Gavin Newsom announced a stay and order to the citizens of California, and that became, of course, like you said, the cascade that followed, which was every other state came forward with their own expression of that stay and order. That began the unraveling of this extraordinary moment.
Tell us about the conversations you were having, because you were, I think it was over the course of something like 10 weeks, you said like 50 hours of talking to chefs and economists and bartenders. Give us a sense of what you were hearing from them.
I think there were a number of things that people began to echo in different areas of the restaurant culture. I think one of the most consistent things that I began to hear in these conversations was, we were already such an impossible business to begin with. Yeah. That the restaurant industry is so incredibly difficult. The margins are so minuscule. I think that consumers, we kind of have a general sense that a lot of restaurants don't make it, or that it's a hard industry with long hours. But when you look at the profit margins of even the most successful restaurants, we're talking about single digits. You know, the difference between a moderately successful restaurant and a hugely successful restaurant could be the difference between a 5% profit margin and a 10% profit margin. Yeah. And as a few people told me along the way, listen, any business major, any finance guy is going to tell you that this is an outrageously bad business, essentially. But people do it because they love it. They get involved in it from the ground up because they feel really passionate about the service industry, about feeding people. And ultimately, we're talking about an industry that employs 15 million Americans. It's a $1 trillion industry. And it is the industry that's been hit the hardest by COVID. It's also the industry that's been supported the least in terms of the PPP loans by the government, in terms of overall packages being handed out to these small businesses. And so the disproportionate amount of relief that's coming to this area that's been hit so hard is where this chasm is coming into play. So an already bad business being hit extremely hard by this historic pandemic, and then not having the support from the government at the level that they need to stay afloat is creating some projections that are saying anywhere between 30, 40, up to 80% of the restaurants that we have in our communities will not reopen after coronavirus.
The TV food personality, Andrew Zimmern, described it as an extinction event for independent restaurants. And I want to key on independence because that is sort of the focus of your piece in some ways. And we should explain that, as you say, you know, the Olive Gardens, the Chili's, the Cheesecake Factories, they're probably going to be okay. It's the local places, it's the independents that could be in trouble.
That's right. I mean, listen, I should say one thing first about chain restaurants, though it's easy to kind of to bag on them or to say they're going to be okay because, you know, they're deep pockets and those things. And those things are true largely from a corporate perspective. But we should remember that the way the chain restaurant model is set up in the United States is oftentimes the owners themselves are independent owners within a corporate structure. And so those individuals can very much be impacted in ways that, you know, are devastating, including the employees themselves. And so it's not to say that those people aren't feeling it as well. They absolutely are. But from a corporate, from a large scale perspective, yes, Chick-fil-A is going to be okay. Olive Garden is going to be okay. But for the extraordinary number of independent restaurants across the United States that don't have those types of liquid funds ready to support, you know, a sudden lack of income, of revenue, those guys are already folding. We're already seeing an extraordinary number of restaurants who have announced very publicly that we're not coming back. And this is just the beginning of it, because there's no end in sight to what's, you know, the impact of the pandemic is going to be on an immediate level. But more importantly, when you project outwards from there and you see 6 months, 9 months, 12 months into the future, you're going to see places that are no longer able to make rent, no longer able to, you know, to pay their employees and to pay their purveyors, and the long chain of individuals who are impacted by this. And that's the part that I think is going to be most devastating to the overall industry.
Yeah. I'm glad you pointed that out, though, because I think it's important not to get too precious about the restaurants that we think are worthy of surviving, although all of us have opinions about that, I'm sure, and we can I do want to talk a little bit about that. But you, for example, the chef Andy Ricker spoke with you, and he talked to you about something I wanted to ask you about. He worried about how if this transition period is not handled correctly, that it could lead to what he described as this homogenization of our foodscape. Talk a little bit about that, if you would. I mean, we're already pretty homogenized in some ways. I mean, if you go from one town to one, you know, Newport looks like Portland, looks like Salt Lake, looks like Des Moines in some strip malls. And
right.
So what do you think about that?
As Andy pointed out, and as a number of other people who I spoke with along the way pointed out, that, you know, while some of the loudest voices in the room right now are people like Andrew Zimmern or David Chang or Thomas Keller, people who have a large platform in the community, the people who we aren't hearing from are, of course, the people who are running these small restaurants that are essentially the representation of a family dream. Mm-hmm. Whether, you know, you were born and raised in the United States or you're an immigrant who's coming over here looking for a way to represent your concept of your home's food culture, those are the places that are going to be hit most immediately by this situation. And when you begin to watch that dim sum restaurant, that taco truck, that Greek diner, that Southern barbecue joint, the places that really represent the quote unquote melting pot of the American food culture, when those places are the first to be hit by this sort of economic devastation, we are really looking at the leveling of a really diverse food culture, this ecosystem that we've grown accustomed to. Especially if you live in a, you know, in a larger town or in a mid-sized city in the United States, you have an option. What are we going to have for dinner tonight?
Yeah.
Well, is it going to be these noodles? Is it going to be a stew? Is it going to be, you know, enchiladas or a mole? Or is it, you know, we have this extraordinary menu, which is the culmination of a long history in this country. And that history is being degraded right now very quickly by the forces of this pandemic. And that's not just about our food options. It's about sort of what our individual communities reflect about us as a culture. And when we lose those nuanced, diverse reflections of ourself, I think that we lose a big part of what it means to be America.
You mentioned in the piece the kind of adaptation that restaurants really, even before this, were already trying out, even before the coronavirus, selling merchandise and meal kits and opening markets alongside the restaurant and going, you know, informal. But the question also comes up in the article that for these restaurants, you know, the owners and the chefs, at what point do you get so far away from the thing that made you want to open the place in the first place that it doesn't seem like the same thing? You know, for some, right, making meal kits is not the same experience as spending so much crucial time putting together that menu and having that one. You know what I mean? Like,
That's right.
Yeah, talk about that.
These people are individuals who are already investing 12, 14, 16 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week, trying to make their dream a reality, trying to cook the best they possibly can, trying to feed people as well as they can, trying to up the game of their service, trying to perfect an imperfectible thing. And that's a long journey, ultimately. But suddenly you're throwing in this extraordinary variable that basically says you're not going to be able to survive on that old vision. You're going to need to adapt. And you're going to need to adapt not in small, subtle ways, but in dramatic, overnight ways. So you used to serve 16 people a night at your beautiful little local communal tasting menu restaurant. Like, I'm thinking of Naomi Pomeroy in Portland, Oregon, who has been an extraordinary voice and a leader throughout this pandemic for the Independent Restaurant Coalition, which is a group that formed in the wake of the pandemic and has been an advocate for independent restaurant rights and the support that they're looking for. Her point was basically saying, listen, I have the exact kind of restaurant that's going to be almost, it's just unfeasible in this new reality. The whole point was to have an intimate space where people got to know each other. You got to meet the people next to you and have conversations with like-minded people and unlike-minded people that you meet along the way. And I can no longer provide the forum for them to do that in. I can no longer be cooking for them that kind of challenging, daily changing menu that brought them all together in the first place. Now I have to be making lasagna or roast chicken and packaging it up and putting it into an Uber,
yeah,
and sending it off into the void.
Yeah.
That for me is not the same as it was before. I was willing to work 16 hours a day under the other iteration of this restaurant culture. But this one over here, that one's really, really tough for me to stomach. And so what you're having is basically the mixture of the already impossible economics of a restaurant combined with people telling you that you can no longer even cook the food that you want to cook because it's not feasible in this new environment. And so it's a really tough pill to swallow, yeah, I think, as people are trying to find a way to survive.
It made me think about a chef who prepared a meal and every once in a while gets to sort of peek outside of the kitchen and look into the dining room and see people chatting and laughing and like really loving their food. And if you, as you say, put it in an Uber and send it away, you don't get that crucial part of the experience.
You feed off of that. That's what you're there for. At the end of the day, nobody gets into the restaurant industry to make money. You just don't. You'd be crazy to do that. You get into it because you want to take care of people. And that's an extraordinary motivation. And when you are suddenly removed from those people that you want to take care of, and you can no longer sort of, you know, help provide the best 360-degree experience, it's really, really challenging. And I know a lot of these chefs, a lot of these cooks, a lot of these people that I've spoken to are kind of going through an identity crisis right now of saying, well, who can I be coming out of this? What kind of restaurant can I own? What kind of hospitality can I give? Just because I can open my doors again doesn't mean that suddenly I'm the restaurant that I always was when people are no longer comfortable coming in. It's a lot of those deep sort of existential crises that I think that the food industry right now is metabolizing, and nobody has any true clear answers from those who I've spoken to.
Matt Goulding, he's a food writer, co-founder of the food and travel website Roads and Kingdoms. His recent article for The Atlantic is called An Extinction Event for America's Restaurants. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Using your smart speaker, starting your day with NPR Utah has never been easier. All you have to do is tell it to play KUER, and we'll be there throughout your morning with news and the latest Utah stories.
Now, the state of Utah has made an important move in this controversial issue. It's the first state in the country to protect.
That's KUER on your smart speaker. Just tell it to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what will be left of the restaurant industry once the coronavirus is retreated. We're talking with the food writer Matthew Goulding. One of the things this pandemic has exposed is a kind of excessive sense of materialism or consumerism in the country. We expect to have a lot of choices, and our expectations of restaurants are no different. But Goulding says for restaurants to make it, that attitude may have to change.
One of the things that I had to grapple with quite a bit when researching the story and talking to chefs and talking to consumers as well was what's baked into our identity as being Americans is choice. You know, we demand a wide variety of choices, and restaurants are a part of that, that we can go out and pick and choose, not just on a macro level, but on a micro level in terms of how do we want to feed ourselves? Where do we want to go? What price point do we want to engage with? And when you remove a large percentage of those restaurants, you're taking away that choice. And I think that that's, I think even for those people who might not identify themselves as deep food lovers, who might not be sort of restaurant hounds, who might not kind of follow the local news when it comes to things like the changing dynamics of a food culture, those things will hit them too. In deep ways that they may not have identified right now, but they will. And it'll change their reality. It'll change their town. And it'll change the way that they can go out and enjoy the world that they have subscribed to. And that is where I think people need to come forward and really support restaurants right now, not just in the sense of ordering food to go or buying merchandise or finding ways to kind of give them your dollars however you possibly can, but actually reaching out to your politicians and making a little bit of noise. You know, the Independent Restaurant Coalition was founded very quickly in the wake of this because there wasn't any representation of these restaurants, which is crazy because, you know, ultimately there are 11 million independent restaurants in the United States that represent $750 billion of annual revenue. And they didn't have a singular body where they could voice their opinion, where they could exert their pressure politically and kind of have themselves represented. But right now they need American support. And whether you're a foodie, quote unquote, at that level, or you're just somebody who really cares about having choice, one way or another, you know, this is the moment to let it be known that these restaurants actually really do need immediate support, both for their own survival, but as well as for a deep sort of economic survival of our small local communities across the country.
Have you found a model that you think could work? I mean, one of the things you write about is Ashley Christensen, who's done amazing work in Raleigh. In fact, I think you describe it as a mini revolution that she's done over there. Is that something you're looking for as a model for restaurants?
I think so. I mean, I think that right now restaurateurs, both, you know, people who own single individual places as well as those who have kind of built a larger ecosystem of restaurants over the years, are looking across the industry for inspiration, for leadership. And Natalie is an extraordinary leader. I live part-time in the Raleigh area. I grew up as a line cook in downtown Raleigh, and I watched what happened when a pretty homogenous restaurant culture was changed overnight by Ashley and her people. She brought in extraordinary work ethic, a generosity of spirit, and a creativity that really helped kind of plant the seeds for a Raleigh restaurant revolution, as you said. And listen, there are dozens of people like Ashley in different communities around the United States who have helped kind of build these restaurant communities from the ground up and support other small business owners. And what she has been doing since the pandemic came was there was probably a week or two where she felt overwhelmed and didn't know what to do and was kind of, you know, a deer caught in the headlights. Mm-hmm. But immediately after that sensation sort of faded, she just said, how can we be better? How can we adapt our individual restaurants and the group as a whole, not just to survive and to continue to feed our community, but also to take this opportunity right now as an industry and really look in the mirror and say, all of these faults that we've had in terms of our worker rights, in terms of pay, in terms of issues as it pertains to gender roles and social justice, all these things that have been a part of the restaurant industry's faults. Ashley and her people have been really working and using this opportunity to address these things individually week by week. And I've been extraordinarily inspired by talking to her and watching from a local perspective, because I spent most of the pandemic in and around the Raleigh area, and seeing what she has done actually has given me a bit of hope for the future. Mm-hmm. It's not to say that we're not going to go through a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, and a lot of loss in the years to come. We will. And we're just beginning to see it right now. If you're seeing your restaurants reopen right now for the moment, it doesn't mean that they made it. It means that they reopened for the moment. Yeah. And I think the real pain is still to come. But what Ashley and a number of other people are doing is saying, listen, this industry has a lot of scars to address. And if we can do that while rebuilding our restaurants, while refocusing a lot of our energy on creating, you know, a better workplace, a happier staff, a more equitable situation, then we will have come out of this situation with at least something to show for it. And I know for a lot of individuals and on a small level, that might not sound like enough right now because they're just trying to survive. And I get that. And that's very painful. But from a larger 30,000 foot perspective, that is the right message. That is the right focus. And I think anyone who's in the position to be addressing some of those issues right now through their workplace, I think have to be at least engaging with those issues and looking to people like Ashley for answers. Hmm.
You mentioned in the story that you imagine this will probably take, this change that's inevitably coming is going to take place in stages. You've got the near present, you've got the post-vaccine sort of period, but then you've got the years into the future part. And I wanted to get to that part. If you can sort of imagine, I'm going out to a restaurant in a year and a half, 2 years, let's say 2 years, sure. What do you figure it's going to be like?
This is definitely some crystal ball stuff, sure, for sure. And this is me metabolizing all the different opinions that I've heard. But I do think what we're going to see right now, it's kind of a polarization of the restaurant ecosystem. Part of this renaissance in the United States has been the creation of the kind of mid-level restaurant that takes food very seriously, but provides it in a comfortable, fun atmosphere. And those restaurants have been doing that at an extraordinarily high level and charging us, quite frankly, way too little. If you look at the amount of money that the average American spends on food, both groceries as well as eating out, you know, we spend about 9% of our overall income month to month on food. And compared to Western Europe and to other industrialized nations, that's about half to 70% of what other like-minded, like-economy countries around the world are doing is just not sustainable. It really isn't. And I know that the message coming out of this is going to be a very tough one to swallow, that Americans need to spend more money on food. That's not going to go over very well right now when everyone is hurting. But I do think over the long term, that's going to be what plays out, that restaurants cannot continue to charge $18 for an entree of locally raised chicken that's been touched by four different prep cooks and took 36 hours of brining and smoking and glazing and finishing. It's not possible, not in the long term. And so I think one of the things that we will see is that a lot of those ambitious mid-level restaurants are probably not going to survive, at least over the next few years. And it's really sorry. I'm really sorry to say that, because those are the restaurants that I love to go to and that so many of us have kind of used as a gateway drug into the food world, quite frankly. So we'll see a lot of the kind of the small, sort of more accessible, fast casual restaurant space will still survive or reinvent itself in a certain way. I think a handful of the lucky, fortunate, well-positioned fine dining options will still make it, because there's going to be a market for that. Maybe not as large of a market, but there will be a market. And then for those who do make it through in that kind of middle space, people like Ashley Christensen, I think, are a good model, where she had, I think, 6 or 7 restaurants coming into this. She's already announced the closure of one of her places. She may lose another. It's hard to say. What I do think will come out of that is that the places that do make it through will be better representations of themselves, where, you know, maybe the portions will be a tiny bit smaller. Maybe the price will be a dollar or two higher, but the people working there are going to be giving you that extra energy because they're better compensated. The quality of the ingredients hopefully will be a little bit better because they're really using their food dollars to support the local chain of farmers and artisans. That I do think that there's a healthier, more sustainable restaurant model that can grow out of this. And we're not close to that. We're nowhere close to that right now. And most people who are still just trying to survive or probably aren't thinking about that. Ashley is exceptional in that way. And as are a number of other chefs that I spoke to who are able to kind of have that foresight. But because they're already thinking about it, it makes me think that those who haven't turned to that thought eventually will, because there's a reason that people like her are pioneers. And it's the reason that they will continue to lead the way. And so I do think that, you know, the model of a restaurant in the future could be a place where you go in, you can have a really great meal. You can also buy a number of products to take home, whether it be wine or condiments. Maybe they offer cooking classes. There's a number of different revenue streams for that restaurant to hedge all of its bets, so to speak, to be a more complete experience, to give it a more diverse revenue stream. And I think that ultimately that's a version of that kind of serious mid-level restaurant that's come to find kind of, you know, the small cities of America and the mid-level cities of America. I think those are going to be the places that will become kind of community leaders in the years to come.
Let me ask you finally, I want to come back around to culture, it's kind of where we began. One of the things you mentioned is that if we don't handle this change right, it can limit the ways people come together. This is how you put it. The ways people come together to celebrate, contemplate, and release. Explain what you mean by that, because that does, again, get us back to that experience of going out for a meal.
I would just ask anybody listening to think about what they miss most about a free and open society. I think a lot of what I miss most personally is being able to go into a restaurant and sit down with friends, to share a meal, to have this experience, to spend a couple of hours at the table. And whether it's, you know, an expensive meal or a cheap one, whether it's a high touch food or something that's just there to scratch an itch, those are places that we go that their value extends well beyond sustenance, extends well beyond just feeding us and sending us home. They become manifestations of what we value most in our local societies and I think collectively as a nation. And so the prospect of losing that in the future is not that abstract anymore, because we have lost it in the present. We are no longer able to do those things. And so if you want to imagine what it's like in a future where 70% of the restaurants in the United States are gone, just close your eyes and think about right now. That's it. That's the reality. And right now we're surviving because we have to and because it's an extraordinary moment. But imagine if we extend that cultural impact to years in the future, where suddenly you are cutting out extraordinary place for you to gather to celebrate the special moments of your lives, of those in your family, you know, to have conversations with people. You know, you only get so many chances in a given year to get together with. You want to be able to maximize those moments, and restaurants are a venue for that. And they provide the kind of service and the kind of setting that allow us to have moments that are not just enjoyable, but quite frankly, vital to our experience as humans living in a country like the United States. And so any ways that we can find to support in the short and midterm, I think will be an investment, not just in the individual livelihoods of those who occupy the spaces and who help feed us, but really in a version of the United States that I myself am deeply invested in, and I think a lot of us are as well.
Matt Goulding, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Doug. Really a pleasure talking.
Matt Goulding. He's a James Beard Award-winning food writer, co-founder of the food and travel website Roads and Kingdoms. His recent article for The Atlantic is called An Extinction Event for America's Restaurants. We have a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER connects you to your community and brings you the facts about what's happening across our state. As part of our service-driven mission, we value your input. What issues should our reporters be covering where you live? Whose stories should we be telling? Do you have a question about a program or a story you heard on the station? By answering a few short questions, you can help us improve our statewide service. Consider leaving your feedback at KUER.org/feedback.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the future of restaurants after the coronavirus. As Matthew Goulding has said, it's really the independent restaurants which are going to struggle the most, which makes this very much a local story. Salt Lake City in particular, and much of the rest of the state, had been going through this boom cycle that Goulding talked about earlier. So we've been asking chefs and bar and restaurant owners how they think this moment is going to change the economics and the cultural experience of going out for a meal in Utah. Brendan Kawakami of Beer Bar wrote to us. He's been a chef for 20 years. Brendan writes that when he started his career, one of the main metrics he used was that it was something he could do anywhere in the world. He writes this: if push came to shove, I could cook anything anywhere and make a living. The difficulties created by COVID were not even a consideration, and it's hard to remain optimistic about the future of our industry. My wife and I have dreamed of opening a restaurant for many years, and although I think it's still a possibility for those who are equipped to adapt, the overall identity of restaurants is indelibly changed for the foreseeable future. Heather Santee owns two restaurants, Eggs in the City in Salt Lake and Herm's in Logan. She wrote us and said that COVID-19 came along and disrupted what was going to be an amazing year. At first, I didn't quite understand the gravity of what was taking place. I thought we would be down maybe a week or two. I wasn't yet in the panic state. However, that slowly set in as the weeks ticked by. That feeling you get in your stomach when crap hits the fan hasn't left me in months. Joining us now in the program is Missy Grice. She's the founder and owner of Public. It's a group of coffee houses and restaurants here in Salt Lake City. Missy, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Scott Evans is also with us. He's the founder and president of the Pago Group of Restaurants. And Scott, thanks to you.
Yeah, thank you.
I guess I wanted to begin by asking you what the landscape is in Salt Lake City and Utah right now. What are you seeing as you talk to friends and colleagues in the business? Missy, go first.
I think, you know, just listening to what you've just hosted and the conversation that just took place, I think Scott would agree. In the beginning, a bunch of us kind of bonded together and we had this group text, and we were talking hourly, daily. And I think we all just kind of have been and continue to wait. It's been a waiting game. And so for me personally, we've chosen to stay closed in anticipation of learning something more next week or the week after that kind of enlightens us and makes us feel confident in reopening. But I think Scott should definitely comment too. I think that really the environment is we're all just standing here a little bit unsure of what's coming.
Yeah. Scott?
So.
Yeah, I've seen, I mean, so many people take different approaches. There's the wait and see. There's, we're going to open in 90 days. We're going to open right away. Everyone's really trying to forge their own path, and no one has perfect information. So I think we're all right and wrong, and there's advantages to both. So we've kind of taken, you know, we closed one of the restaurants for 40 days or 60 days. It's all blur now. And then we tried to keep a couple of them open, takeout only for a couple months. We've just really taken different approaches, and I'm seeing everyone doing the same thing. We all have different metrics that we're applying to our decisions, and the metrics change constantly.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, Matthew Goulding mentioned how the virus and all of the economic problems now has exposed and exacerbated what he called these fundamental flaws in the restaurant business. And he, you know, in his article, he talks about low wages. He talks about abysmal working conditions. He talks about razor thin profit margins. And that's not even to mention what happens in some of the industry, sexual harassment, deep-rooted discrimination. What do you think about that idea, the idea of fundamental flaws being exposed?
One of the advantages of being in a smaller market is those flaws are smaller. So now the playing field's a little bit more safe in a small to middle market like Salt Lake City. Yes, those things exist. I think the biggest one is always wages. That's something that we keep trying to solve. How do you balance the tipped employees? And our restaurants typically do much better than the hourly wages from the back of the house. That's a constant problem. The restaurant community that I've always worked in is incredibly diverse. So we have a diverse, I mean, we've had lots of diversity in leadership and the top of the management. So we haven't experienced as much of that. Yes, we have experienced sexual harassment in the restaurants that I've been with, but we've had a pretty firm policy from the beginning that it's not tolerated. Doesn't mean it hasn't happened and doesn't exist, but I do think Salt Lake is a great place in that sense, where it's not to the same degree as bigger markets like LA, Chicago, New York, even Portland and Seattle. And I think that's part of why a lot of people come back here after working in those markets, is they do want to slow down a little bit. It's a little lower burnout ratio than in those markets. And it's why when I post jobs for my top positions occasionally in other markets, that's the reason why they apply, is they want to have a balance. And I think that's one of the attractions of Utah and Salt Lake in particular.
Missy, what do you think about that? To the kind of the bigger point, that is that maybe this is a time now where we can fix some of the big problems.
Well, I agree with everything Scott said. Just smaller market, we're all, and especially now, having, I think our industry has really come together. So we all already knew each other, and our employees are often friends or roommates, or definitely share, you know, social circles. I think the biggest flaw that I've been looking at is just wages, and basing that off of the CARES Act and what my employees have been able to collect through unemployment, and having that be more than what I was paying them, or any owner was paying them prior to COVID. But I, you know, as far as the discrimination, sexual harassment, again, we do have a smaller market, and I think that our small industry and our small restaurants here, I think people are very cognizant of that. And I personally just, I feel a little bit nervous about how this will go the next year or 18 months. And specifically pointed to wages, you know, with limited dining and dining rooms being smaller with distancing. What does that mean for tips, right?
Yeah.
Fewer diners.
Right. The question came up also in Matthew Goulding's writing and the conversations that he had, was that this theme developed and this idea kept coming back, which was, it's not coming back like it was. Scott Evans, do you think that's true? Do you think that it's going to change? Maybe not drastically, but certainly significantly?
I do, especially. I think it's the complexity of that question is also, it hits the segments so differently.
Yeah.
So for our restaurants, like, you know, obviously casual dining, if you have a drive-through, you're crushing it. You're doing really, really well. If you are set up for grab and go, you're doing really well. Those segments are growing. We're hearing that from our food sales people. Like, this area is doing really well. Fine dining, casual fine dining, like Arlo and Pago and Finca now on 15th. That's where the creativity has to change. We're doing so much to-go business now, and we never would have. We've never accepted to-go orders to the scale we are now, and we're promoting it. We want people to, and we're building systems that allow it to, you know, to make it smooth and work. And that was not common before this. So I absolutely think if we can get 10 to 20% of our sales to go, if we can sacrifice 30% of our margin for those food delivery services, that's going to change. Yeah. There's going to be more forced negotiations with those third party vendors. There's going to be other creative, less expensive options for that, because that's not sustainable for us.
But Scott, are you okay with that? Because
I'm okay with survival. That's the
point. And Missy, on you on this point too, because a lot of the reason people got into this business in the first place is one of the things we were mentioning with Goulding was chefs wanted to prepare a meal and set it out on a table and go, you know, peek in from the kitchen and look at people enjoying that and loving that. And is it ruining the reason you got into this experience in the first place? But as you said, I guess, yeah, we want to survive. So you're willing to go through that to make it, I suppose.
Yeah. And I honestly think we've been open. So we have a different experience than Missy's restaurants. Yeah. We've been open for quite a while. So my main reason was to employ particularly my top people who wouldn't do as well on unemployment as some of the entry-level jobs. Everyone in entry-level job did better on unemployment than they did, you know, collecting tips or working the line. The chefs and the sous chefs and the managers, took a bigger hit on unemployment. So my intention was to keep them busy and motivated, and I wanted to be able to reopen more smoothly. So I think that's going to be another challenge that I have friends that are, I'm concerned about being closed for 6 months and then all of a sudden ramping up and reopening. That's a heavy lift. It's like opening a new restaurant, even if you've been in business for 10 years. So that is a big hurdle. But for me, I wanted to keep it going, even though if it was a trickle of the business we had. But the positive part is we've been experiencing in a very smaller, you know, 50 to 60% less lower capacity, we've been experiencing guests that come back in and say, "Oh, thank you. This is what I've wanted to do.
I feel safe.
And I wanted to feel human. And even though my table's next to me is very far apart, at least I can feel their energy and hear the roar and partially understand what the server's saying through their mask to me."
Right.
So it's different, but it is, you get glimpses of what you loved about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little less personal.
Yeah. Missy, what about you?
I echo everything Scott has said, just experiential. And I think for me, staying closed really was more of a financial protection of my employees. And now that we're looking at activating our PPP, we're going to be opening two of our locations for takeout at the end of the month. But I am looking at this as temporary, because culturally, I think that Public, we've built more of a space and an experience. You know, it's not fine dining. You know, we're not providing that much that someone can't make at home. Yeah. You know, we do have excellent bread, but if someone wants avocado toast, they can make it at home. But people come to Publix to be in the space and to see their friends and to potentially run into their next door neighbor or a coworker. And our dining rooms have been historically just about community and gathering. The food is good. The coffee is really good. And I'm proud of what we've built as far as a product, but we've also built a space and spaces for people to come together. So this pause and this waiting game for me has just been incredibly, it's just been an intellectual marathon of trying to figure out, okay, so who is Public now and who will Public be and what will we be on the other side?
Yeah.
Because really for me, just personally, I built a space to gather.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
The experience.
Yeah.
Outside of the food. Yeah.
Right. Scott, you've said you have to be optimistic in the restaurant business. So you have to be really optimistic right now. I'm guessing, do you still feel that way?
No, I do. And I'm, you know, I think that's the reality I've experienced both as a manager and server and everything before I opened my own restaurant 12 years ago, but it's still, you just kind of, you see a problem and you try to find a way around it. And it's just, there's just so many of them. The rate of problems coming at us is so unbelievable, warp speed, Star Wars style, but it's still, I feel like we'll get through it. And I've already had to make incredibly hard decisions with my group and all the changes we've had to do, but I'm willing to do it. I feel like we'll get on the other side. I know there's ways through it. I'm constantly, you know, working with my team and just kind of looking at what people are doing across the world. There's a lot of inspiration of creative ways through this that I've seen other people do. And I feel very far from giving up at this stage. I feel like we'll get through it.
Yeah. I want to thank those of you who responded to our questions. We heard from Justin Solberg, the chef owner of Nomad East and Nomad Eatery. He talked about how it turned our world upside down. Ryan Lauder of the Copper Onion said, anytime you can sit and reflect may be good. However, this is like living in a stick house during a hurricane, and the weatherman doesn't have anything good to say going forward. Scott Evans, the founder and president of the Pago Group of Restaurants, Missy Grice, founder and owner of Public. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, Scott.
Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.